Hello, it's Peter Wright and Kathleen Beauvais in Ontario, Canada, with another excellent episode of the Yakking Show exclusively for our premium members. These are the episodes where we bring you really successful business people to give you actionable tips and ideas to move your business and your life forward in ways you might not find anywhere else on the internet. So first, let's introduce co-host Kathleen Beauvais from Waterloo, Ontario. Hi, Kathleen. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you. And thank you all so very much for tuning into our show. You know, Peter, we have the great privilege, as you said, of interviewing people from literally all over the world that are experts in their fields for our premium members. And today, of course, is no exception. We have the great pleasure of welcoming Samantha Stone to the show. Hello, Samantha. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you. It's wonderful to be speaking
Hi,
with you
Spencer.
both.
Thank you.
Now, Samantha is an author and a fast growth B2B marketing strategist, researcher, speaker, and consultant, and the founder of the Marketing Advisory Network. So, Samantha, before we get started and delve into these wonderful topics, can you please, for our audience, give us a little bit about your background and what led you to help companies develop effective marketing strategies?
This might be a longer answer than you intended. So, but
That's
we'll
okay.
give you the short version.
Nope.
I actually graduated college with a degree in economics, and I had full intentions of going into public policy research until I actually did a project working for a government agency. And I learned something very true about myself that I am way too impatient to do public policy research. While my spirit and intentions are good, and I do love research very much, to enact a change from a policy perspective is many, many years for all the right good reasons. And it is not in my body to be able to do that. And so I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do now, but I applied to graduate school because that's what you do when you don't know what you're going to do. And I needed to work in the meantime. And the very first job that I got through a temp agency was at a technology company. Never in a million years would have seen myself in that field. And I ended up, in the short version of the story, working for this technology company, falling in love with the fast-paced nature of what we were doing. And I did channel sales for a number of years. And at one point, I started doing my own marketing because I was impatient, as I've shared. There were things that I needed that the direct marketing, corporate marketing team weren't able to do for our partners. And I'd like to think that I was helpful enough, but maybe pushy enough might be a more accurate description. That at one point somebody says, "Fine, Samantha, you can do this product log and marketing, but why don't you own it?" And that's when I transitioned to marketing, and I realized that I truly loved it so much more. I was good at sales, but I just absolutely loved the ability to impact things at a greater scale than a set of accounts. But also that it was really hard. And so the combination of challenge was fantastic. So I like to think that a degree in economics taught me sort of analytical thinking and data-driven decision making. My sales background made me very sensitive to buyers and sales processes and those types of things. And then I learned marketing skills, sort of by doing, and eventually took some formal training in it as well. And the combination, I think, has what has made me good at what I do. And 10 years ago, I decided that I loved my work, but I had become very senior in some bigger organizations, and I missed doing the day-to-day work. I was spending most of my time sort of internally politicking. So I founded the Marketing Advisory Network to get back to the work that I loved and to be able to help multiple companies at the same time. And that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years.
Wow.
Wow, very good. Well done. So we're going to be talking about all sorts of aspects of marketing as we go through today. But one thing that worries me, and this is what where I'd like you to start off, is coming out of 3 year, almost 3 years of totally disrupted society with the lockdown, and towards the end of last year, that the sudden, for many people, explosion of AI type or AI based software programs, apps, whatever you want to call it, there's two huge disruptive forces together here, and there's been casualties in many industries. So, where do we go from here? So, what's in front of us, and how can you help businesses shift their strategy to cope with all that's going on? Over to
Yeah,
you.
this is really, all of that change and things makes me believe that we have to go back to our foundations. Mm-hmm. We got really caught up as marketers and sort of the next shiny object. We get often caught around the cool campaign, the cool tool that I want to use. We need to go back to basics. What are we trying to achieve? Who are we serving? And then how best we do that. And there will be technology to help us achieve those goals of better serving our customers, but it's not the driving force. None right. of us should be going in and saying, we need an AI strategy or a personalization strategy or webs. What we need is a business strategy, and marketing should be derived, and the things we do in marketing should be derived from that. So I think that's sort of number one. And even if we've understood our businesses, so much has changed in the last 3 years. We need to go back and continue to constantly do that kind of research and really understand our buyers and what's changed for them and how they prioritize and how they buy and to do all of things. And we now have a whole bunch of new tools that, frankly, enterprises who have a big budgets have been using for a long time. These are not mm-hmm. actually new technologies. What's no. new is that the average person, me, you, my uncle, my best friend, are starting to talk about AI text generation and content generation. Mm-hmm. It's like brand new thing is unveiled. Well, there are people who've been using it for a decade now. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the good news is we know what doesn't work and yes. and how not to use it. And we have models about how to use these things to advance ourselves. And the thing is to be open to how that and where to apply it. I have been studying artificial intelligence for a number of years and its application to business and marketing strategy. I did some primary research right before the pandemic. And then I redid the research after we got a couple years into it because I knew that things had shifted. And the research I was doing was to better understand, when do I use artificial intelligence mm-hmm. in interacting with customers? And the thing that came through most clearly in this research is that in routine tasks, I want to know when you're open. I want to look up my account. How much does something cost? I want to configure some things. Things like chat box and automatic systems and automated personalization are great, right? We don't always want to talk sure. to a person. Those are good things. I can use those technology to build, personalize maybe a demo I want to present to someone. All good. Right. In moments of frustration or concern, interacting with an automated system is the absolute wrong thing to do. I don't want to know what hours the bank is open. Somebody took $500 out of my account and I don't actually know who that is. I want to talk to a human to solve it. And that right. research was very, very clear. Every time I've gone out and talked to almost 1,000 consumers to get that information fed to us. I did two surveys, one before pandemic hit and one after. And actually it was wildly consistent in this regard. Mm-hmm. And so that shows us that we need to use technology to make things easier, to make things more effective, to be cleaner, but we can't lose the human component in certain parts of our process. The other thing that data told us very clearly was that we need to be transparent. If someone thinks, sometimes you go on and it's very clear, I'm talking to a chatbot, for example, and other times we use a name mm-hmm. or a picture and they're trying to pretend it's a person. That's all well and good until something goes wrong. When yep. something went bad, one of the things we did in this research is I put a very, very frustrating chat experience script in front of all these people. So it was purposely a bad one that didn't have a happy conclusion. And I showed it to people in three ways. One group of people got the analysis that showed a person's picture and a real person's name. The mm-hmm. second got a name, but no picture. And the first one got a name like chatbot, right? So it was very clear that that was
it was a bot, yeah.
People scored, who am I willing to work with this brand or this company again, right?
Yeah.
Much, much higher when it was clearly transparent it was a chatbot, because they were willing to accept this bot didn't understand me. I didn't get what I wanted, but that's okay. These systems don't always work. When we pretended it was a person, same exact experience, their likelihood to do business with that company plummeted. It just dropped.
Really?
Almost 20%.
Interesting.
Big, significant difference.
Interesting. And that is very interesting. Huh? Yeah. So the other big area that you're researching is shifting buyer trends, which have been shifting and always will continue to shift, obviously. So let's look at that in the B2B sphere a little bit more.
Yeah, there are so many things that we could talk about, but there's three, there's really three big ones that I think are really important for us. Well, there's four, one of which we've been talking about, which is this notion about trust. Inherently, we're operating in a place of distrust. Even if we're the most trustworthy company, we keep all of our promises, our buyers, the world, the context they're living in is to distrust things. And so how we use technology transparently and where and when we use it is a really critical piece that we need to address. An equally relevant piece of this puzzle is around digital e-commerce for B2B buying, right? Even for complex buying. People are expecting consumer-like shopping experiences, even when I'm buying a $50,000 software package for my company. Right. And it has big implications for how we in our business create our websites and where we use our salespeople and how we do things like take orders or share information or give away, show us case pricing and things like that. So this need to have these digital commerces across all spectrums of products and services is a really new phenomena in many of the kinds of organizations that are out there. We buy cars now, right? Without ever going to a dealer and without ever test driving that car. It's not just possible. People do it all the time, every day now. It really shifts how we think about what complex selling processes are all about. So that's a really big one. And I can, let me give you an example of an organization that really just dropped the ball on this with me recently. So I have been using, I won't shame them, so I won't name who they are,
sure.
but I've been using an e-signature tool to do contract execution for most of my business. And I'm a relatively small business by design and intention. And so I have, not a high volume of contracts. It's literally for signatures. I don't use 90% plus of the functionality of this tool, but I have found it a convenience and easy for my customers. And so I use it. And my renewal is coming up and they're significantly increasing the price of the service that I've bought for them for many years. It's gone up a little bit before, but this is a pretty big jump. Well, this company did something smart. They looked at the volume and the functionality that they use and they said, "Ooh, she's not going to like this." And so they sent me proactively a communication that says, "Hey, we're raising our prices to this. It's a significant jump. But we have a starter pack that we think is going to better match for you." So far, they're doing great. Awesome. So I reply to that email solicitation. And I say, "Awesome. What's the price of the starter pack? I'm sure it does what I need. I only need these two things." And the salesperson says, "Let me set up a meeting." I said, "I don't need a meeting. I just need the price."
Right.
So would not set up a meeting, wouldn't give me any information wouldn't confirm the functionality, wouldn't any of these. Now I'm a longtime customer with very clear needs. And it's very clear to me what happened. They have this outbound salesperson whose entire focused pay structure is on getting a meeting versus getting a renewal.
Right.
If they had incented to get the renewal, they'd have my business today. Instead, after many attempts, what I have done is I turned off my auto renew and I'm not going to use the service anymore. Cause you know what? It was convenient, but it wasn't hugely necessary to me. And there's many alternatives that are easier. So this company failed to recognize the shift in how I want this buying experience. And probably way back in the day, I probably did talk to a salesperson and had a bunch of questions. I don't need to do that anymore, right? And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is looking at and examining how do our buyers buy things from us?
Yeah.
And how do they want to buy things from us? And how do we close the gap between what we want to do and what they want from us? Because there's no reason that poor Brian, outbound calling team, spent a lot of time chasing me.
That's right.
We could have had a renewal, right? With just an email. Yep. That's all we needed.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to get your opinion on something very similar to that. Sorry, Kathleen, I'm going to jump in before I forget this one. That I've had several instances recently of service providers where I've phoned them. One was my mobile phone and internet provider, And I phoned to ask why there was a certain charge. And they then said to me, we can actually give you a new package that will save you money. And it's obviously a package designed to entice new, brand new customers coming in. And it was fairly significant saving. And I thought, well, if I hadn't phoned, you would have kept on charging me what you were. So how do companies solve the dilemma of advertising or offering attractive packages for new customers without upsetting their existing customers?
They stopped doing that.
Yeah.
They just stopped doing it. It's a technique that we have used because we understand, but if there's too much transparency in the world today, there's
right.
a time when the only way I knew what the price of my cable company was, for example, right, was
yeah.
through an ad or conversation with on the phone. It's impossible to hide that right now. So there's no way to do what you're describing without
That's right.
frustrating people.
So sure.
what they need to do is optimize their pricing model for profitability. That is
yeah.
different necessarily than optimizing for new customer acquisition. And so they need you need to rethink how we think about pricing. This is a great example. I'm so glad you brought it because it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about is rethinking the commerce experience that we create for our customers with what people are expecting today.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot
mm-hmm.
hide this information. And it's not just that my neighbor across the street might have a deal and tell me. I now am going to see it. I'm going to Google on the website and I'm going to see it. Right? It's just...
Yeah. That's
it's
right.
something we have to stop doing and instead think about what that right balance is. Customer retention, right, is a revenue stream that we traditionally in marketing haven't spent enough time on. We spend, mm-hmm. most of my clients, this is an unscientific data point, but my clients spend 95% of their resources on marketing and new customer acquisition.
Yeah.
That's it. Yet, if you look at their actual revenue stream, it's much closer to 50, 60 or 70% is current customers. And yes, you don't have to work as hard necessarily to keep a customer as to get a new one in. And so there is different things that you need to do. But our focus is completely skewed too far in one direction. And I believe that there are exceptions to this rule. But for almost all of us, we want to build profitable businesses, not just a business.
Yep.
It's not just about getting to a number of customers. It's about making money. And money
for sure.
might not be, maybe you're a nonprofit. It's about fundraising to good cause. I mean, you know, it could be maybe you're a government agency and making money means serving my community in the most cost-effective way. Whatever that sort of core value is. And so we have to rethink how we approach serving our audiences in this context. The biggest, and we've seen this, the reason there are tens of thousands of people being laid off in the tech sector today is because we overhired.
Yeah.
There's no other way these companies can continue to operate with very little disruption to their customer base as they are today, except that they overhired.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, we see that even at small scale. We see smaller companies say, well, I want to do 3x revenue growth. So I'm going to hire, if I have one salesperson, I'm now going to have 3 salespeople. So we think that's the math we have to do. But it's a flawed approach and it isn't matched to how our customers are buying things today and the ways that we can reach out and build those rapport and those relationships.
So with all the changes that we've been discussing, are there some industries that are likely to disappear altogether?
That's a really good question. I'm sure there are. I'm sure eventually things change. I think the way I think of it is how things will adapt and be different. So for example, my grandparents' generation worked literally for the same company their entire career.
Mm-hmm.
And they the majority of their career. And then they mm-hmm. retired and had a part-time job doing something else. My parents in their generation worked the same job for different companies.
Yeah.
Over their career. My children will have multiple careers.
Mm-hmm.
They will do different work for different companies over the course of their lifetime. And I think that is not because occasionally a whole industry is going to go away, but it's more that the task at hand to do in that job is going to change quite substantially. I think we see this a lot in things like bookkeeping and accounting. We've already seen this, right? With the rapid adoption of things like QuickBooks and other systems and tax preparation things, a lot of the work of what was a bookkeeper and accountant is really, I can go in and I plug in forms now, right? And I get that at data. Does that mean accounting and bookkeeping have no role? Of course not. It means that their role is different. The work that they do is different. How they serve their customers is different. Are certain specific jobs in accounting and bookkeeping gone? Yeah, probably. Or if not now, will be eventually. But they're, so I think of it more as an evolution than of a, you know, sort of elimination of work.
Right, right. Here's an interesting one. There's some categories. You were talking about e-commerce in the B2B world. Part of my background was farming. My first job out of school was with my father's farm, and then I farmed on my own for many years in Africa. And I'm connected with quite a few farmers here in Ontario. And I was talking to a dairy farmer the other day, and he's young, he's mid-30s, early to mid-30s, and he's caught up on this whole e-commerce thing. And he was saying, you know, we don't get many sales reps coming around anymore. He says, I'll get a sales rep trying to sell me something new, but once I'm a customer, I just get on the internet, order the stuff myself, and pay with my credit card, and it gets delivered, so I don't need a sales rep. So I would imagine some of those agricultural and perhaps other industrial sales reps' jobs are in some sort of danger because not a lot of need for them.
Yeah, not a lot of need for what they used to do.
Yeah.
So is there a need for them to introduce new products that compete with a current, perhaps? Is there a need for them to teach people how to use their product initially, perhaps? Like, so, the tasks that they used to do, the, you know, running around to farms. What I won't do is I won't show you the dying plant that's like over here now, because you it's a little embarrassing giving agriculture and farming. I do not have a green thumb at all. It's a little miracle that plant is alive there. It's real, but it thrives on almost no attention. So that's another example to me where it's not that salespeople who serve farmers in agriculture don't need to exist. It's the work that those people do now is completely different than the work that they used to do before.
But by the other side of that coin is a whole lot of new job categories have emerged in agriculture. We now have drone operators, right, scanning farmers' fields for the health of the crops, even taking samples and analyzing the soil by drone. You know, 15, 20 years ago, there was no such thing as a drone operator in agriculture, right? So
completely. I had solar put on my office here. Yeah. And when they did that, a drone and satellite picture, I don't even think a drone, I think just satellite pictures, designed my system, told me, was able to build the pricing configuration for me, told me how much power I would be able to consume based on the light and the locations and all the things that go, you know, this complex formula that I don't understand, right? And then a salesperson stepped me through the installation process, because you got to connect an electric company. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, a whole bunch of people who show up at your house to do things. So the salesperson didn't need to do the pricing work. I'm sure they used to have to do all that stuff manually. But now they had to do work to help me be comfortable with the changes to the roof of my house, how many people are going to show up in my yard, right? So I think similarly, we're seeing that happen over and over and over again in so many places.
Yeah. So let's go in a slightly different direction. All three of us are members of a very, I think, unique community on a platform called Discord, which has its frustrations. Discord, not the people we talk to. I find that it a treasure trove of information, wisdom, and ideas from people like yourself and Mark and a number of others. And we're getting a lot of benefit. One of the big topics that we're discussing in there is community-driven marketing. Now, that's obviously more applicable in the consumer market than the industrial market or business market, but I think there's parallels that are important for the business market. What's your thoughts on that, Samantha?
Yeah, I think community is everything, right? I really sort of fundamentally believe that. I was on the Discord channel, and it's my son walked by, and he's like, "Are you on Discord, Mom?" He saw the little icon, and I am. He's like, "What are you doing?" Because he uses it for gaming and does, you know, sort of online things. So it was kind of a funny conversation. And then I explained what I was doing, you know, and what that community was all about. And it has, community has a fundamental role in building belonging, right? You know, Mark Shaver has this great book that he's just published, Belonging to the Brand. And it is exactly the right way of thinking about this, which is, yes, sometimes customers just buy stuff from us, right? And they just do. And that's totally fine. And I love when people just buy things from me, right? People sometimes find my book. I had nothing really to do with helping them find the book. I got lucky. Maybe somebody recommended it. So that's wonderful. But if I really want them to build a relationship with me, with my company, with my brand, they need to feel a part of something, right? Mm-hmm. And buying something does not make me feel like a part of something, right? And so if we really want to differentiate ourselves, if we really want to change and adapt with our customers, change is going to happen. Do I want my customers to stick with me and change with me and we change with them? We've got to build those bonds and those communities and those connections. And that means letting go in a way that is often hard, right? Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. One of the things Mark has told us, right, is that he set up a bunch of communication channels that he thought were topics we were going to end up talking about. And some of those ended up being the least active.
Yes.
Right? Channels.
Yeah.
But a whole bunch of things we hadn't even thought about popped up where it is a really fabulous, high quality conversation. And lots of people are building connections. We're building connections with each other, but also with him, right? And
yeah,
with
absolutely.
The sort of overall mission of Rise. And I think that is what most of us have to do in our business. And we've talked about community and marketing for a long time, but most of us haven't really lived it. Most of us are not doing this today. And I think that we are going to need to do it more and more and more as things continue to change and evolve.
Yeah. And you know, when you think about it, it's not new. If I think back 40, 50 years when, as I said, I was a farmer when I first left school, and we, the little village I lived in Africa, we had a cattle sale once a month or so, and all our cows went there. And the farmers would all sit around afterwards having a beer, and they would say, well, which vet are you using? Where do you buy your cattle dip from? And it was within that community. If someone said, well, that guy's good, if you want this, go and talk to him, people did, right? So it's something that I think we've lost.
We used to have to buy things in person, right? We used to buy things with a phone call. And the more digital the buying becomes, the more important the community becomes, because you can't accidentally come across people in that world. So how do we bring them together digitally to do that? That doesn't mean, offline doesn't have a role. It certainly does for many things, and community can have a non-digital component, but the digital piece of it is just fundamental and required today, where it wasn't, certainly not 20 years ago. We did very little digital community work, and we have the technology to build a digital community. We just didn't need one.
Yeah, we didn't. Kathleen, what do you got? I'm monopolizing Samantha's time here.
So Samantha, maybe you can talk to us a little bit more about the B2B marketing strategies and how you help your clients with working out what strategy they need in order to expand their businesses.
Yeah, I do a lot of different kinds of work for different organizations that are in different stages. What I typically work with are companies who have, sometimes I work with startups who are launching for the first time, and we can talk about product launch, but that's its own entity and its own beast, right? It's its own thing. Most of the time I'm working with companies who have an established business, but they've hit a plateau. They're growing, they've grown, but they've kind of gotten stagnant. They can't get past the stage that they're at. And we're trying to figure out why, like what is getting in the way of us getting to the next phase of our business, whether that's opening a new location or growing revenue or becoming more profitable. A lot of times companies are grow and they have reasonable revenue, but they're not very profitable. And so sometimes we're looking at how do we become more profitable as the goal within the current footprint of the business. And a lot of the things that we're doing is doing this work is where is there friction in the buying process? And how do we remove the friction from the buying process? And businesses often think about marketing does this, you know, set of things, and we have sales and then we have service, but our buyers don't look at it that way. They look at the whole spectrum of the interaction. So how do we map that whole spectrum, and how do we see where are people stuck today? Where do we annoy people is kind of where I usually start. Where are we frustrating people? Where are they beating their head saying, oh, that's a good product, but they're driving me crazy, right? And how do we fix that? What products are doing really well? What products are failing, right? Sometimes it's just not a good fit for the market, and that's okay. And you remove that from our portfolio. Sometimes it's a really great product that people don't understand or has been packaged wrong. Sometimes it's a really good offering, but people use it differently than we intended. And so we've got to sort of adapt around it. And so we spend a lot of time understanding what are you good at, where was those friction points exist, and how do we eliminate that friction points to make sure that we're creating the best, most useful experience. And then that, you know, that strategy then becomes, okay, now I've really got a tight audience, a tight message, a tight offer. Now we can start talking about what campaigns might I run, right? Mm-hmm. Where might I advertise? What community, you know, where am I going to build my community? It's one thing to know I want a community, figure out where I'm going to build it might be something different, right? What has really worked for us in the past and what can we let go of, right? Maybe mm-hmm. it used to work, but it doesn't work anymore. Well, I had that conversation today with a client who was really having a hard time letting go of a particular program. In this case, they are actually a nonprofit organization, and they have a bunch of really great things that they do. And one of the things that they do every year, which is really fun, is they run this concert series in our local community. Their nonprofit is all about community building and coming together. But I said that we went through all this tonight and it just didn't, one thing didn't feel like the other, right? So I said, why do you do that? And they had an answer. And I said, that made sense. But the parameters, the reason they did it initially, no longer exists. Years later. And so it's really hard to let go of that. So I said, okay, you emotionally don't want to let go of this. And that's okay. Sometimes that's, you know, a criteria, but how are you going to turn it into something that is valuable to the organization? Because right now it's a really cool thing. That's a nice to do, but it doesn't serve your actual mission. Mm-hmm. So how do we turn it into a fundraiser, or how do we turn it into something else, right? And those are the kinds of conversations all of us need to have all the time with our businesses, is what has changed about us or our buyers or the competition? And how do we adjust our strategies to be more aligned with where the market is today? And that means, you know, those 5 years plans that we all learned how to build, you know, feel free to build one if it makes you feel good. I believe in 5-year goals, but how you're going to get there, there's no way that anything I put on paper today is actually going to be what I'm doing in 5 years from now. And so instead, how do we build adaptable structure and process and policy and measurement in how we operate right now over the next 6 months?
So can we turn our focus for a moment to promotion? How would you advise a company that, you know, they may be doing well, but they could always do better, and they're trying to figure out the best way to promote themselves? I mean, is it so? Are companies still flocking to social media? Is it something else? What would you advise?
It's a really good question. I think I do believe in sort of a multi-channel approach. I think that typically works best. So I don't think there's like a single thing. If you advertise here, all of your growth needs will be met. I think that's very unlikely for most organizations. So I do think it takes multiple things. But I'll tell you the most underutilized tool in our bag of tricks is word of mouth and referral activity. Almost any business I have ever met could have significant growth through better, more structured advocacy, referral, and sort of word of mouth initiatives. Jay Baer has a great book, Talk Triggers, that talks about how do you not just deliver what you do, but deliver it in a way that makes people talk about it. And we, in all kinds of businesses, highly, highly underutilize that mechanism.
Sorry, Kathleen, can I jump in? There's just two quick points before I forget. I was having a Twitter chat, was private message with someone I hadn't been in contact with for many years, because I'd read something on her blog and noticed she was an affiliate for a hosting company, and I'm having a bit of a hassle with the company that I use for hosting. And she replied, won't shame them by naming them. And she said, they're okay. My irritation level with them has not overcome my inertia of changing. And I thought that should be framed and put on the wall of most companies, because isn't it so true that we put up with all sorts of stuff, and then suddenly it overcomes the inertia of changing. So, I think a lot of companies are guilty of that. What I was going to tell you, from as far as word of mouth goes, is that with my farming background, when I came to Canada, my wife bought me, I had horses and do a lot of stuff outside. She bought me a thing called a Leatherman. If you've got any farming connections or handyman, you know, it's a little tool you carry on your belt with the whole deal. And it comes with a lifetime guarantee, right? And I had that thing for 15 years and I broke the screwdriver blade. My fault. So I emailed them, said, you know, I've broken the blade. Can you send me another one and I'll fix it? They said, no, we fix it in our workshop. You'll have to pay the postage to get it to our depot in Canada, not in the USA. And they will send it to our base. And I think they're in Washington or Oregon, somewhere on the West Coast. And we all send it back to you. And sure enough, they sent it back to me and no charge, right? And this is an item that maybe cost $40 15 years ago. They replaced it, sent it back, no charge, beautifully cleaned and polished, the knife sharpened, and then checked another follow-up, said, did it arrive safely and are you happy with it? I thought, wow. You know, that sort of service for that low item is, and that's really stuck in my mind. So if anyone says to me, what do you think of Leatherman? I say, wow, they're one of the best you can get. So,
it's very true. And that's the thing about it. And it wasn't just that they fixed your screwdriver and sent it to you, right? Huh. They polished it. They sharpened a knife to act, right? They created the experience around it to be truly remarkable and to exceed expectations. The fact, when we exceed expectations in some way, right? In some way, that's what gets people talking, and we don't spend enough time looking for those opportunities. So yes, should we, do we need to advertise? Sure, there's value in advertising. There's value in social media. There's value in PR. There's value in all kinds of channels. But what, unless you have something for people to talk about in the way you deliver, those investments are not well spent.
No.
And so what those investments should be amplifying, not your lead. They're not the thing that's going to make you successful. They should amplify your success. And we need to take that step back and start first. You know, people start with, I need to buy a marketing automation system, right? And I need, okay, that's a useful tool. What are you going to send people? What are the offers that are going to be there, right? Like, until you have things to feed the engine and remarkable experiences, it's you'll get an initial bump because doing something is always better than doing nothing. But you will hit a wall really fast where you don't get incrementally, you just get incrementally better. You don't make another step and another leap unless you take that step back and think about those remarkable things about you that your customers are going to value, like Leatherman did with you in that experience. And I do know my husband and son are in construction, so not in agriculture.
Okay, so I saw you smiling. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, they definitely, we care a lot about tools in my house.
Yeah.
we break a lot of tools in my house.
Another one on that is equally good, if not perhaps even better, is Snap-on. My brother was a diesel mechanic. He had his own workshop, and he bought Snap-on tools in Rhodesia, which it was called like 30 years ago, and then he moved to England, and he had a socket from his set that was broken. And the Snap-on man came around and he said, can you fix this? He says, lifetime guarantee. There's a new one. Yeah. So they're very good as well. I want to get back to what you were talking about just now, the way when Kathleen asked you, how do you work with companies? I would say, and I'd like your comment on this, that many of us in business have a feeling that are struggling to grow, your clients that you're helping grow. We have a feeling we need to do something, but because we're inside the business, we can't see it. And it takes someone like yourself, an outside facilitator, to come in and let us see the wood for the trees, for an old British saying. So what's the first step? How do you do that?
I really should be a marketing therapist in my LinkedIn profile, which is oftentimes people don't even know what they should do, but they can't get the backing or the support to do it, right? Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing I do always, no matter what it is that the service is, no matter what the obstacle is I spend time to understand two things: what their real goals are, right? What are they really trying to achieve? And yes, there's a revenue number to it, but there's something beyond a revenue number that is driving the sort of mission of the business. And then I understand their customers, and I understand their customers by speaking to them. There's just, you know, data is super useful. It helps point me in the right direction. But I ultimately, you've got to observe customers and what they need and want and why. And when I say customers, it may not be actual people who bought from them, but the buying community that they want to attract. So the very first thing is always that internally, sort of letting people have that moment of catharsis. What do you already know? Where are you stuck? What are we trying to achieve? And then get to know them and observing what the quick fix is. Sometimes the answers people don't like, because sometimes the answer is you've been spending a lot of investment in this thing over here. It doesn't have a market, or it has a market that's, you know, not attainable for you. You really should stop doing that. In other cases, it's, you know, you have this product and it has five big capabilities, and you've been talking about one and two capabilities because they were the hardest to build, right? We do that a lot, or the hardest to deliver. But the thing that your customers care about is actually number three.
Right. Right.
So let's talk more about number three. How do we prioritize messages and prioritize delivery? So it really is just taking that pause, that moment to try and really understand who, what are we trying to achieve for whom, and what do those people care about to solve for that? And then, you know, and then there's some balancing of resources, right? Some companies have very limited resources. Some companies have very robust resources, and that affects the strategies that I take and what I'm trying to do and trying to grow. But fundamentally starts first with understanding buyers and understanding goals. Now, one of the things that I've observed, I'm curious to see if you've also observed this, is I often am brought in by a person. Sometimes it's the president or CEO of a company or a founder. Sometimes it's the head of marketing. Sometimes it's the head of sales or revenue. And they have told me a problem they're trying to solve, you know, that that is this. And then when I get the bigger, broader group of people together, I often find that they are not aligned around what they're trying to do and who they're trying to serve. And so we often even take a step back to just get the team aligned around that. And we use data to do that, right? We look at, where do you actually make money? Where is your, where is competition weakest? What are you trying to achieve? What would make you actually feel good aside from financial metrics? You know, with these other things you care deeply about, where are you strong? Where are you weak? And try and rally around that. And a good portion of some of the strategy work and planning work is around getting the team on the same page.
On the same. I agree with you 100%. The real problem is very often not the one that you're asked to solve, right?
I'll tell you this little in, and I think you'll both appreciate this. One of my first consulting clients hired me with the explicit goal to double the number of leads that came into the company. That was the goal. And at that point in my practice, I guess I signed on for that. I probably would handle the discussion a little bit different, but I signed on and I did what I always did. Okay, fine. Let's look at what you're doing. And I did an audit, and then I talked to buyers. And I came back and I said, okay, we've got a plan of action. And I sat down with the head of sales and the CEO, who were the people who brought me in. And I said, I have awesome news for you. And they're like, oh, yes, Samantha, we're so excited. I go, we are going to cut your leads in half. And they're like, what? And I said, we're going to cut your leads in half. And the mouths dropped, and to their credit, they didn't kick me out of the room. They got quiet and they were waiting for me to explain. And what I explained to them is they didn't have a lead volume problem. They had a lead quality problem. We stepped through all the stuff that they were going through and what we're going to do. And we did exactly that. We cut their leads in half. We kept their budget identical in terms of financial resources and people resources that we were allocating. And we grew revenue 25% in the next 6 months.
Wow.
Right. But if I did what they asked me to do, which was to double
their problem worse.
The number of leads, they would have been, it would have created a different problem. It wouldn't have actually solved the business problem, which is we're trying to grow our revenue and we're hitting a plateau. We think this, they thought the solution was more leads.
You're absolutely right. That's not uncommon either. Uncommon. Here's another one for you. Do you find when you go into businesses, major differences in perspective depending on the generation of the either the owner or the top management? So if you have old boomers like me in charge of a business, do you find they're generally facing a different set of problems if you have young people like yourself or even, you know, very young entrepreneurs? Is there a generational disparity, or is it pretty common across the board?
It's an excellent question. I think there are definitely generational preferences in how we communicate that is different. And I think that is very real. But I actually think the difference I see more is less generation about who runs it, and it's more about the structure of the organization. Is it a family-owned and operated business? Yeah. Is it a corporation that has a board? You know, like how the company is structured makes a really big difference versus how old the person in charge is. Mm. In my, you know, sort of my experience, that's been the bigger difference.
Okay. Mm. Okay, interesting. So carry on, Kathleen.
When I introduced you, I mentioned that to the viewers that you're an author. Can you tell us about the book that you've written?
Yeah, thank you for asking about it. Unleashed Possible, it's a marketing playbook that drives sales is sort of the name of the book. And it was really born out of all my work. So when I first started doing my consulting practice, I was really fortunate. I had a great network. I grew that business pretty steadily. But I had a lot of people who couldn't afford to pay my consulting fees. And I really did want to help them. And I wanted to find but I didn't want to just give my services at a significant discount. I'm the primary financial support for my family, and that's financial stability was important to me. And I didn't want to do that. So what I did was write this book as a way that I could help people and in a completely different way. I'm not going to lie. My sister published a book right before me. So there was a little also motivation of, I want to get my sister. That was definitely there. But it was really a remarkable. So I started doing it to serve people that I couldn't serve through the traditional way, but I actually served me very well. So while the book was based on a lot of things that I had already published and written as a starting point, it forced me to get really clear about what I believed about an approach and why, because I had to write it down in a book format, which is different than other formats. And mm-hmm. So I wrote the book to be really a handbook. It's, you know, it's designed to be very prescriptive in the kinds of things that you can do. It doesn't tell you how much money to spend on advertising, but it tells you how to think about how much I need to do and for whom, and how do I evaluate things and how do I measure things. And so I'm really proud of the work, and I'm super fortunate that I still today, a few years later, get notes from people about how much it's helped them. I get a lot of comments like, were you in my last board meeting? Or boy, you should have sat in my sales call like you were in the room with me and my sales executive. and it's because, you know, a lot of the things that I talk about are really common challenges. Mm-hmm. And I've experienced them firsthand. And here's how I tackled it and the things that I've learned along the way. The good stuff, I share some, you know, bad experiences and what I'll never do again. And also some things that did work well.
Oh, jolly good. I've got to agree with you that I wrote a book. It's up there behind me. And you're right. It really does concentrate your thinking on what you've done and what you should be doing. So much so that both my sons read my book, and I have one son in Africa and one here. I happened to be complaining one day, and the son that lives in Canada said, "Dad, why don't you read your own damn book and listen to..." That shut me up fairly quickly, you know. So
I love it.
We'll soon be getting towards the end of our time, and I have a couple of questions for you. But the first one I want to ask you is, looking ahead, we are worried about recession. We're worried about all sorts of things. I say worried. We have concern. I'm not worried about anything. Worry's negative. There are concerns about possible recession, unemployment, and on that one, there's this strange situation where we have skilled people who can't find jobs, and we have in our little town every coffee house and retail service place, we're hiring signs on the door. They can't get enough people to serve coffee. So that's odd. But there are concerns looking ahead. Is there a sort of little nugget of advice you would have for small to medium-sized business owners, what they should really be thinking about looking ahead for 2 years?
Yeah, I think it's a really excellent question. And I think it is absolutely the reality. And I think the advice that I give people is to focus on profitability. Mm-hmm. We often focus on growth, and growth is a meaningful and rewarding thing to focus on. But in times like this, when things are tough, when things are uncertain, when there's a lot of change going on, profitability is key because it will fund whatever you have to do next. And so great. I really encourage people to think very carefully about that and help use that to drive the decisions that they're making about what they do next and at what pace. And that will provide them some security for what needs to happen. I also, the other thing that I tell people all the time, this isn't my area of expertise, but it's an area of observation that I've made, which is we are always looking for people to fill open positions and things that have a very specific profile and background and resume. And I understand the legacy of that. I've done that myself very much when I've hired people in the past. But we are in a learning-based society today, mm-hmm. and so it is more critical than ever to look at cultural fit and a person's ability to adapt, because it's going to be hard to find them. Even with, you know, big recession and layoffs of certain kinds of roles, it's hard to find the perfect fit. It's hard for people to fit in there. So don't rule out really interesting people with talent, because they don't fit they're not coming up on your keyword search of the resume that they've sent over to you.
Yeah. There was a bit of sage advice way back, and this must have been in a business book I read 30 years ago. I can't remember who wrote it. And he said, if he wants to employ good people, he takes attitude over aptitude every time, right? Which is sort of what you're saying. So here's another important one that I like to ask all our really successful guests, and you're certainly in that category. So Samantha, with your wide experience in the corporate world and in your own business and just talking to people in general, is there one characteristic, mindset or habit that sets the successful, and I don't just mean acquiring wealth, I mean achieving a contented life and a balanced life and being relatively well off. Is there something that sets those people apart from the average who remain frustrated and stressed and never really make it, or is it more complicated?
I do think it's complicated, but I do think there's a couple of things that have been successful for me, and I've observed a lot of people that find success mm-hmm. and balance, which we often think success equals financial success, and that certainly has been part of my success, but it's not the only thing. When I founded my own business, a big part of my mission was to make as much money as I made before, but to live a much more contented life. And in fact, I make more money than I made before and live a much more contented life. So those things can happen. But as my children are now becoming adults, I don't actually need to make as much money as I made before. I can dedicate myself to other things. Not that I'm willing to give up a paycheck. Let's not get crazy, but we look at what success means for us. And I think there's two things that I've seen. One is constant goal setting. So the mm-hmm. right kinds of goal setting is really instrumental to whether you're an individual person or an organization and want to create behavior and kind of things. So I think goal setting is something we don't spend enough time on. We go, oh, there's a revenue number. That's our goal. But it's way more complex than that and way more opportunity than that. The other thing is something that I practice a lot, which is being uncomfortable. If you want to be successful mm-hmm. in today's world, you have to be good at getting uncomfortable. And one of the ways that I did that to support my professional life was something I actually do in my personal life. So every year, and I've now done this for many, many years, is I take on a new hobby. And my goal in taking on the new hobby is not to master any new skill. In fact, I'm truly terrible at most of the hobbies that I take on. But that is, in fact, the point. The point is to be uncomfortable doing something new and to continue to be learning something new, even if I never master it. And that has served me well. And part of why I started doing that was when my children were younger, they exhibited some of the same. If you just looked at my human nature, it would be, I don't like doing things I'm not good at. Like I like to be good at things and I am reticent to do things I'm not good at. And in one of my children in particular, when they were, 10, 11, 12 years old, trying new things, they just didn't, they shared that characteristic with me. And I found myself being like, I have not set a good example. And so we would have these kind of, I'm like, you just need to try. And they'd look at me, okay. So I started doing this hobby thing as a way to sort of prove out and showcase mm-hmm. this uncomfortableness. And it impacted my work and way more than I thought it would. And it has made me, I think, far more successful because I can experiment and try things where that I would have been hesitant to do in the past. And in experimenting and trying and letting go more than I might have done before has allowed my business to evolve. I'm doing sort of category as I was when I started 10 years ago. But, the actual work I do and how I do it has definitely shifted.
Good. So you've got to tell our audience, what's the latest hobby? What's this year's hobby?
Yes.
That's a good question. I don't actually know what I'm going to do this year. So it always falls to me something in January and February, something will happen that just hits me over the head. Last year I did ice cream making because I got an ice cream maker as a present from someone. So I did that. One year I did sculpture because my son was really interested and we took a sculpture class together. It's a whole nother story. Showing up with your preteen child to a sculpture class and there's a naked woman who's there. He was way more mature about it than I was. I give him incredible credit. He was so good about it. And it was meant to be artistic, but I was not prepared as mom. Let's put it that way. But very proud of my child who handled it absolutely wonderfully. But so I did sculpture. I've done cake decorating. I've done kayaking. I've done yoga. I've done painting. I've done so many things. So I'm not sure what 2023 will be, but it will fall on me in the next bit, and we'll give it a try and be terrible, terrible, terrible at it, and be able to laugh at myself. And you never know. Some of the things I try do stick. Not most of them don't, but occasionally something comes on. I did yoga one year as my new practice, and I still practice this now 15 years
very
later.
Good.
Wow.
Excellent. I got to tell you that having been told as a junior school pupil many years ago that I would be absolutely useless at music and never be able to play or read music, at the age of 67, I went out and bought, I needed a goal. So I went and bought a guitar and taught myself to play music. I'm not good.
I love it.
I'm not good, but the same, I've done very similar to you, lots of other things that have made me really starting a podcast. When we first started, this was scary, but we love it. It's really good.
That's right. So, well, Kathleen, we are running low on time. Yes. Samantha, can you tell our audience how they can contact you?
Absolutely. I would love that. And I actually have a course that I just launched that I've put in place that sort of teaches a lot of the things we've been talking about finding. And this is about sort of that, some of that trends around self-paced learning and things. So I hope people check it out. But if they go to unleashpossible.com where they want to check out the book, the course, just who I am, or just say hello, they can go directly to unleashpossible.com. You can schedule time directly on my calendar from there. You could just check out some of the content, connect with me on LinkedIn, of course. I love meeting new people because part of why I still practice in my consulting is I'm better at giving advice and strategy when I see other businesses and what they're doing and learning along the way and what they're struggling with. So I love a good talk therapy with someone. I'm happy to do it anytime.
Excellent. It's been
excellent. Oh, we really appreciate that.
Yes. Yes. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today, Samantha. And once again, thank you all so much for tuning in. And of course, we welcome your suggestions for the type of expert guests you would like us to interview here on the show. Feel free to reach out to either Peter or myself. All you need to do is visit theyakingshow.com and click on the contacts page. We would love to hear from you. Until next time, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.